This is London calling.
You are listening to Thought and Leaders.
Hello, 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 and welcome again to another global podcast that is Thought and Leaders. As you know, I scour this beautiful, amazing, elegant planet of ours to find the most inspirational, the most insightful, the most intriguing speakers out there. Now, my guest this week is someone who is absolutely amazing. He's quite remarkable. His name is Jamie Howell. He used to be in the forces, and he's also a resilience coach. So, good morning, Jamie.
Good morning, Jonathan, and thanks for the intro.
Yeah, it's a great pleasure. Now, let's go straight back to the beginning. So, I understand that you were born in the luscious Luton.
In Luton, indeed, yeah, that magic town in Bedfordshire. I lived there up until the age of about four before the family moved across to Leighton Buzzard, small market town in Bedfordshire, about sort of 12 miles up the road.
Your granddad was very interested in aircraft or engineering or something like that, was it?
Yeah. You know how you get these train spotters, you know, they go around and they sort of take the chassis number of the train and perhaps stood there with their little black notebooks and the binoculars.
Well, oh, yeah.
Granddad of old, so my dad's dad, was an avid plane spotter with aviation. Back in the day, he also did a stint with the RAF and sort of initially trained as a pilot. He took me under his wing. So from an early age, and I can remember being sort of 5-6 years of age and staring, you know, from the perimeter. So looking directly through the metal mesh fence, I mean, face pressed up against it. And I had half a binocular, so a broken pair of granddad's binoculars, my little brother, 2 years younger, by the side of me with the other half. And there I was staring through the fence, granddad off to one side with a Gucci, brand new, sort of shiny pair of binoculars, because he was the spotter. And we're looking at the active runway on the aircraft and the pilots obviously busying themselves, throttling up the engine. And just that noise of coming sort of back downwind towards us, and the incredible sort of scent, the smell of the kerosene fumes off the back of the jet engines, and that backwash. I always remember the atmosphere just electrifying for a young boy. And perhaps that was where, for me, the seed for aviation was perhaps born. And I always thought that maybe one day I'd like to get involved and try that myself.
Yeah. Those fumes of the aviation fuel, they will play a important role in your story. Now, at some point as a youngster, you decided to have what a lot of youngsters like to do, which is you had a trip around the world.
I did. I had this kind of real itch as a young man, you know, sort of fresh out of school. So I worked for about a year, save up some pennies in sort of local jobs. And then I went off armed to the teeth, if you will, with an around the world ticket from Trailfinders.
I remember them. Yeah.
Yeah. I went to Johannesburg in Southern Africa. I ended up working on a market in Camps Bay near Cape Town. I was a salesman selling African curios, arts and crafts. And then later on, I was in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
And I did a couple of jobs randomly, you know, some gardening work. I worked in a McDonald's. I was a cocktail barman for about sort of 8 months in a very famous joint in King's Cross.
Nice.
And then the creme de la creme for me was that I went up north and I volunteered my services to work within the diving industry. And from before too long, I was a qualified PADI dive master, so a supervisory sort of grade. And I was able to guide, punters on the Great Barrier Reef at a ratio of 1-8.
Okay.
And I did more travel around Australia, sort of through Fiji, Hawaii, New Zealand, North America, and then sort of finally Miami, Paris, London. And yeah, I was well over a year on the road before I finally got back to the UK.
Now, when you did get back to the UK, you had a sense that you wanted to do something to do with the services, whether it be police, whether it be army. You decided to have a pot at the police. Is that right?
I did. I mean, when I got back from backpacking, I found it a little bit tough to sort of settle down. You know, I'd done this magic year all around the world and had some amazing experiences and all that exposure young. And initially, you know, I just wanted to continue the adventure. So the way to do that, I was thinking, was join the forces, because, you know, you get that opportunity to travel perhaps again and, you know, training and various pursuits. Initially, I was considering the Royal Marines. And certainly they could offer me that. But a friend of mine locally said to me, well, you could have just as much fun and games, you know, in terms of the challenge of the job and the everyday sort of excitement, perhaps, you know, doing what I do. And he was an officer in Luton. I remember making the call to Beds Police. And they said, oh, I'm really sorry, sir, but we're not recruiting at the moment. And there I was feeling, you know, markedly sort of deflated at that point. And then they said, the recruiter on the line said, but actually, I do know that TVP up the road, Thames Valley Police, are recruiting. If you're interested, I can give you the number. It was another force sort of over the county border covering Buckinghamshire, Oxfordshire and Berkshire. So it was an even bigger force. Phoned up and, you know, sort of a year on, because I was selected for service with Thames Valley Police.
A lot of people, they don't realise that there's more that goes on in a police force and in a local area than they may assume. I understand that you got involved even with murder cases, is that right?
They were a bit short, perhaps, on the CID, the Criminal Investigation Department, and often I'd get sort of, pinged by one of the, perhaps the detective inspectors to say, look, we need some help. Typically, my inspector would perhaps send me along to give some assistance. I ended up being tasked to help investigate a couple of interesting cases. And you do deal with the darker side of life within that job. Often you're dealing with the victims. There was a case in Milton Keynes outside a nightclub. So there was a young gentleman that had been in one of the local nightclubs. And let's just say, to paint the scene, picture the scene, he'd been dancing with some girls in the club. And they were just generally friends of his, and they were all out in the small party. And there were some guys tried to muscle in on the action, but the girls didn't really want to know, and they were sort of, you know, more or less rejecting them and turning their backs. You know, but guys being guys, they kind of kept at it. And then when the doorman basically kicked everybody out at sort of after hours, people were sort of chatting away as they do before generally the crowd disperses and goes home. These guys were generally trying to muscle in on the girls again. All of this came to light within the court cases that I remember. So they're trying to muscle in again on the action outside. The girls didn't want to know. And then what happened was the young guy that the girls were with basically stepped in and said, look, the girls aren't interested. Just leave it out, kind of thing, and sort of be on your way. They didn't sort of heed that advice. They started to get quite confrontational, and they started pushing and shoving this lad around. I guess he sort of feared and he ran off. They chased him onto some local wasteland or waste ground, probably about half a mile up the road. And I guess the guy ran in there for a bit of cover, but they managed to catch up with him. So they beat him up. If that wasn't enough, one of the others came up with a vehicle. They basically piled him into the boot of a vehicle. They drove him out to a rural location where there was a river. There was a small humpback bridge. And then they'd sort of taken him out of the vehicle, sort of roughed him up a bit more, went to throw him over the humpback bridge to basically dump him into the water, having been beaten up quite badly. And as they went to throw him over the side of the humpback, he's kind of hanging on with his fingertips over the side of this humpback bridge. He was pleading because he couldn't swim. And he was saying, I can't swim. So one of the assailants here grabbed a hammer from the glove box of the vehicle and proceeded to hammer on the top of his hands as he was holding onto the bridge. He then fell, you know, some distance. It was about, say, 10 feet into the water. So he managed to sort of somehow scramble to the side of the bank, even though he claimed that he couldn't swim. Get to the sort of semi-muddy riverbank, and they'd actually run round. And one of them went forth and basically sort of rugby ball sort of kicked him in the head at more or less point blank range, having come down the riverbank. This chap went back into the water and that was it. That's one of the jobs that really stood out in my mind, really quite harrowing. There was another incident where we got a call one night. There was a sudden death to attend, and it was in the multi-story car park. I remember it was one of these sort of dark and stormy nights. We got the call, it came over the radio. We drove up towards this multi-story. We carried on sort of around the winding track that led up to the top of the multi-story car park. As we got to the top, there was a security guy in like a high-vis yellow jacket that sort of beckoned us on and sort of said, look, come with me. So we went forth in the vehicle, you know, headlights illuminating sort of the rain coming down. As we approached, there was another gentleman stood outside a plant room, if I remember, which is like an electrical room, you know, that houses all of the instrumentation and the sort of controls for the car park. And we got pulled into there, and there was a young gentleman, I'll never forget that, but this one, I'd seen a few. So this sudden death was a young gentleman, actually a colleague of theirs that worked in the car park, so also in a high-vis yellow jacket, security guy, but a young gentleman. And he'd basically climbed up a ladder in the plant room, 10 feet or so, quite a tall building on the top of the multi-story car park, tied a rope, and then subsequently jumped. And I always remember finding that really quite tragic, very sad, simply because not just the scene, obviously, but he wrote three letters. One addressed to his parents. There was a letter addressed to his ex-girlfriend. So I think you can kind of understand and surmise from that, you know, what actually happened. And there was a letter actually to us, the police. And for that reason, I found it particularly sort of tragic. And it just resonated in my mind that you never really understand what's going on, of course, in another person's mind. But how somebody could sort of generally feel so low to sort of stoop to that level and commit the sort of ultimate act to end it. And I found it hard to really fully understand that and get my head around it.
Understandably, after that, you took a sabbatical to travel and to kind of widen your experience, didn't you?
I'd been around the world already and then some as a young backpacker, and I'd done some pretty exciting sort of jobs. And I thought that perhaps the bigger, greater world had something to offer.
Yeah, of course.
So I took the sabbatical or applied. In those days, you could actually blag up to 5 years, which was quite impressive. So I thought, 5 years, wow, that's going to give me a fantastic opportunity to get out there once again. But I thought this time I'm going to perhaps do something a bit more structured. So I chose to do a university degree course, and I did a languages degree.
Oh, really?
BA honours in Scandinavian languages. Bit bizarre. During my time at university, I stumbled across the Cambridge University Officer Training Corps, which was the army for all intents and purposes. And you could join this outfit as a reservist. And I thought this was great because by now I'm sort of 25 years of age. I'm a mature student. You know, I'd had all this life experience, being an ex-police officer. You know, I'd seen a bit of the world, so to speak. And the army really appealed to me because it gave me structure and it allowed me to spend my weekends fortuitously and with focus and learn something and earn a few pennies to sort of keep myself afloat financially. I thought it was a fantastic opportunity for a younger person to do all this and get involved.
You were recommended to join something quite special.
Yeah, so later on, having been exposed to various aspects of British Army, and I did P Company, so the selection for the parachute regiment, and I did a short service kind of commissioning course at Sandhurst, a Royal Military Academy.
Wow.
And then following that, I'd sort of exhausted what the OTC could offer me.
Yeah.
And I got recommended then for service with UK Special Forces, which was an awesome opportunity. And then I embarked on a 13-month selection program for UK Special Forces. Now, I surprised myself here because I was pretty robust. And you know, I was strong. I was kind of in the prime of my life, sort of mid to late 20s. And I got through the process actually first time around. And I gradually, you know, surprised myself that I got through after that year or so. And then I was badged into a unit called 21 SAS or Special Air Service, which is the reserve component. And I then had the fantastic privilege and opportunity to be a part of the squadron with the regiment as a whole and have these opportunities to again travel to different parts of the world.
You went from freezing to boiling.
I experienced temperatures down to minus 45 Celsius in the Arctic.
Yeah.
We went really quite high in the Arctic. And the one unit that goes that far north in particular to maintain a capability in sort of Arctic warfare. So I had the, you know, the privilege of training in a very hostile environment. And then I also experienced from temperate environments in the UK and Europe to locations in sort of deepest Africa, in sort of more desert. Great opportunities. I loved it. I was absolutely in my element, and it was sort of in my blood at the time. And I was as happy as I could be.
5 years you were a reservist.
Well, altogether I did about seven and a half years service, if you include the time in the Cambridge OTC.
But of course, yeah.
So yeah, altogether, it was about that period.
At one point, you decided that you, well, I guess you must have thought of grandeur because you had this ambition to fly, and you had a short window of opportunity. So what happened?
Yeah, so it was the summer of 2007, and I'd basically been given the nod that, you know, as par for my service with UKSF, that I was due to go on an operational deployment, and it was quite a big sort of job or tasking. And I'd been given, you know, we'd been given a little bit of downtime and said, look, you know, you've got a bit of time to sort of to go away and, you know, have a bit of a break and then come back sort of refreshed, and then we'll essentially ramp up the training and then we'll deploy it. So I thought, okay, I'm going to use this time effectively.
Yeah.
And I'm going to fulfill an older personal ambition, and that was to learn to fly. So like any sort of project or plan, you have to not just walk the walk, but you have to talk the talk, put my money where my mouth was.
Mm-hmm.
So I found myself going to the US embassy to persuade them that I was not a security risk, to get a visa specifically to learn to fly in the US. And I specifically chose to go to Florida in USA because of the better chance of a good sort of meteorological window and the likelihood that I was going to get the flying done in, you know, more or less a 5-6 week window.
Okay.
Again, before I was due to go back home and sort of ramp up the training with the army. Fast forward a month, I was now pilot in command, now solo. Don't forget, this was an intensive training course. It wasn't a part-time thing. I was fully immersed full-time. I'd been solo for about 8 days, and I'm in the pattern doing sort of maneuvers at about 1,000 feet indicated on my altimeter. All of a sudden, I had a moment where my engine flared up sort of externally, and I saw a thin streak of visible yellow-orange flame out the left-hand canopy window, and I could see that it was streaking coming from the front portion of the aircraft, sort of the engine, and I knew that it was an emergency. I knew that it was for real, and I knew that I had to get the aircraft down sort of hastily and as quick as I could.
Did you go through like a process of this is what I've got to do, because you are trained to deal with a crisis?
The fire is now about halfway up in the cockpit. I just decided that I'm going to veer away, so away from the concrete runway in the distance, head towards a grassy embankment gently to my left, because it was essentially softer ground. And I started gliding in, and I'm still descending, watching the altimeter spin down. And then roughly from about 500 feet, I immediately went into the emergency protocol. So I followed the checklist for emergency, systematically shut everything down. So in sequence, following the checklist, I turned the key to the ignition off, the red switches for magnetos, Alpha and Bravo off, the master switch off, the lights off, the strobes off, in the center column, fuel pump off. I then rotated the fuel selector valve through 90 degrees and off. And very low level now, I ripped off the headset on my head, threw that in the right-hand side footwell to get it out of the way because I was concerned about the flex lead cable. I managed to unbuckle the three-point harness around my waist and my shoulders carefully and sort of wriggle out of that. And then, so left hand on the control stick, right hand on the throttle, I was able to then, about 100 feet, I opened the left-hand canopy door. There's an increased wind coming into the cockpit and I'm on fire. And it started to burn and lap my feet and ankles. And as I'm descending, the fire within the cockpit is building up the whole time. So then what happened was very, very low level now. As I mentioned, left hand on the control stick, right hand on the throttle. I'm doing a kind of controlled glide, having scrubbed off as much airspeed as I can. Sort of 50 feet, 40 feet, 30 feet, judging it purely by eye now and not instruments. And then at sort of 20 feet, I was more or less sort of jackrabbit up onto the seat. I managed to clamber carefully on the seat, climb out, sort of step out over the door lip onto the left wing. And then sort of looking out towards the horizon, I took a giant leap from the trailing edge of the left wing. Snapped my feet and knees together in the air, and then also clapped my hands above my head. And that was a sort of a good old-fashioned British Army parachute exit position, so from the trailing edge of the left wing. And I was running in at about 30 knots, which is, you know, probably nigh on 34 miles an hour. And I was probably about 1.5 or 15 feet when I actually jumped from that wing, and hence was able to exit the aircraft. Whilst burning, whilst on fire, if you will, that was the motivation. I was absolutely terrified. I managed to roll around in the long Florida sharp grass. It's like razor grass in the tropics. And this grass was probably 8-10 inches high. And luckily that offered me, or afforded me, some friction. And I was able to roll back and forward, sort of human sausage shape on the ground, to smother the flames. But I remember thinking that I'd smothered the flames, but my right shoulder was still burning like a Roman candle. So with my left hand, I was able to pat out the right shoulder, and also my right of scalp. So with my right hand, I was able to pat out the Roman candle, which was on the right-hand side of my scalp. Before I jumped, I was receiving the backwash of the propeller all of the way down the right-hand side. So I've got a very distinct right side dominant physical burn.
Yeah.
Having patted out the flames, I remembered the aircraft still obviously airborne on that very sort of, from a very low level on a short trajectory in towards the ground in the distance. So I turned instinctively to look towards the aircraft, and unbelievably, I was able to watch my own aircraft through sort of red fingers. The propeller was still about 6 feet off the ground, and then she subsequently crash-landed. There was an ugly crashing, crumpling noise. Nose heavy, left wing down, embedded itself into the ground, into the earth, sort of dirt and earth flying everywhere in the distance. And then following the crash, there was a pause of some 8 to 10 seconds. And then all of a sudden, this almighty boom. And it was like a veritable bomb going off, only a very short distance yet. We're talking about 100 litres of low-lead blue, which is a high-octane aviation fuel in the belly of that aircraft in the tank. And that went in a wunner. There was an immediate shockwave that came through me and then back again as it sort of pushed out all the air mass and then sort of reverberated back. But fortunately, I was just outside of the fire radius of the explosion, but not by much. And I desperately remember crawling away as fast and hard as I could, sort of leopard crawl through the long grass. But in doing so, that sharp grass lacerated my elbows, my knees, my face. I had a bilateral nasal fracture from a secondary impact, face versus the ground, having jumped. I had supraorbital eye socket fracture, so both eye sockets above the eyes fractured, ruptured my large intestine, lacerated my liver. But the worst of it was the fact that I was 63% third and fourth degree burns. So the fourth degree burns was my lower limbs and the front of my tibia, my shins, which received the longest period of burn in the cockpit. And I had exposed bone from the tibia, hence fourth degree burns. So that was a life changer. It was a career stopper and indeed a real showstopper for me.
Now, they pick you up by ambulance and they took you to a world-renowned facility. How long did they keep you there?
So I was drug-induced for 6 months of my life in the US and then subsequently in the Chelmsford Burns Unit in Essex. But for the first 4 or 5 months, I was in the States in the drug-induced coma, and they worked relentlessly, tirelessly on me. This was the doctors, the nurses, the medics, and the specialists, 24/7, around the clock.
God, good God. In terms of being in the fight of your life, were you giving up?
Even though I was going through the mill of it all, pneumonia, septicemia, you know, renal failure, and that real acute fight. But the reality is, when I was sort of roused back from being in the sort of drug-induced coma, the reality of the recovery sort of kicked in and what lay ahead for me. And that journey was just hell on earth because I was now conscious. It felt like a real uphill battle. And I faced 62 surgeries over the first 7 years of my life. Just a nightmare, all kinds of reconstructive procedures. I had a lot of skin grafting, so that skin of my own. I had, you know, human donor skin from cadaver. I also had pig skin, artificial skin. And it was a bit like sort of Humpty Dumpty, you know, they really had to try and sort of piece me back together again.
Right.
I felt like I was in that war of attrition, that it just wasn't happening for me.
So at that point, you really were at your lowest.
I hit the very lowest ebb that perhaps a man can stoop to in his kind of humanity.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to give up at that stage and throw the towel in. So I set myself on a quest to end it.
Yeah.
I had a visit from a gentleman in the church, and from what I understood, he was on a secondment to Oxfordshire. He came and he was very sort of relaxed, and I wasn't really in the mood for entertaining anybody, so it was a very sort of nonchalant sort of dialogue and sort of verbal exchange that we'd have. But we got briefly talking about, you know, my situation, and he basically turned around and said, "Look, I'm prepared to help you, and I'm prepared to assist you." And I couldn't believe that, because that's what I wanted. All I needed was someone to effectively hold my hand and say, "Okay, fair one, I understand. I will support you. I will take you. I will drive you out to where you need to be so that you can go through this process." And in a nutshell, I was enthusiastic about the idea of assisted suicide. And this gentleman then gave me an ultimatum before he left after one visit. And he said, "I will help you, but I want you to do something for me." And I guess this is the business end of it. And he basically said, "Hold on for one calendar month.
1 month more, and that's the deal."
That was the deal. And he said he would support me, but he just said, "Hold on for one calendar month. That's all I ask." A couple of days later, I had another skin graft operation. This time, I believe it was skin that had been ordered in. It had been transferred to the burns unit in Stoke Mandeville. I'd been through this process again and again, but I thought, what the hell?
Yeah.
They put me under for the operation. Many hours later, I woke up. To my amazement, the pain wasn't as bad as previous ops.
Yeah.
5 days later, when the nurses on the burns unit took down the dressings, you know, they were amazed at the sort of progress that I'd made from the recent op. And indeed, the word sort of miracle started to be bandied around amongst the nursing staff. And it was like, "Oh my God, Jamie, this is a miracle. You know, you're really starting to turn a corner suddenly." That was all the hope that I needed. And that then enabled me to effectively see the light.
You used the word miracle. Are you a religious man?
There's things about the whole concept of religion that I'd like to believe in. I'm also in tune with sort of science and the universe and all the rest of it. And I do have an underlying faith, let's just say that.
It's miraculous, but it's still a lot of healing to go. It's about 3 years healing, is that right?
Yeah, tremendous. So I had, as you say, about 3 years of physical healing, but interestingly, about 5 years of sort of mental or cognitive healing. And
so you had psychotherapy?
I didn't know. I should have...
You had no psychotherapy?
I just was so sort of determined with that sort of dogged mentality that I was able to just push on myself and ultimately rehabilitate myself. And I did that through setting goals and challenges for myself. I mean, I effectively had to learn to write, to feed, to walk all over again from sort of ground zero and really rebuild myself from scratch following that injury. Once I learned to walk again, that wasn't easy because initially I was sort of buoyed up with a giant sort of baby grower style harness with two strapping male physios behind me in the hospital sort of supporting me.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult, you know, not least because I'd lost soft tissue and nerve from my lower limbs. So I ended up with a partial paralysis in my sort of feet.
Right.
That made it very, very difficult for me with the whole walking and challenging myself. But with great will and determination over the course of time, not only did I learn to walk, but I went on to walk many miles within the local area. And towards the end of the third year, I got an opportunity to go on and do the London Marathon, which is quite miraculous given what my body had been through.
It's interesting about separating the body from the mind, because some people, they have a crash and, of course, it's severe trauma to the brain.
When we still have the mind, we're able to use that to affect, to nurture our own recoveries and to really drive forward. And believe me, from my experience, if you want it badly enough and if you're hungry, you can still achieve remarkable things in life. Albeit in my case, you know, it was in this new body, in this new skin, and I was now effectively Jamie Hull version 2.0.
And so what happened to Jamie Hull version 1?
Well, I would say 1.0 was that the former all singing, all dancing, quarterback, sort of all-star track athlete, that guy kind of gone.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not the same athlete that I was by a long shot. You know, it's a new sort of toolbox that I've got. I'm still quite active. And I like to push my body a little bit.
Mm.
I don't quite have that same athletic ability that I did have.
You do amazing charity work with people like Help for Heroes.
I did 3 marathons. So I did London, New York, and then a subsequent London. And I was able to power walk. I mean, this wasn't easy, again, because of the legs and the injury, but I was able to do the first marathon about 8 hours 30.
Fantastic.
In New York in 7:07.
Fantastic.
And then the final marathon I did in... best effort. I know I couldn't now, you know, improve upon that. 6 hours 15.
Incredible.
And it's not so much of a boast, but it's just the fact that, you know, even with the physical injury,
yeah,
and the disability, with great will and determination, you know, we can still go on and surprise ourselves and achieve incredible feats.
Yeah.
But you have to have that hunger. You have to have that mindset. And then I climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, the highest freestanding mountain in the world. And then I got an opportunity through Help Heroes to do Race Across America, it was, on basically a 3,100-mile bicycle race from West Coast to East Coast USA. I took part in the first inaugural Invictus Games and helped Prince Harry to sort of kick off that Games in London. And I was a track cyclist.
Amazing.
To be part of that was just incredible, and have the crowd sort of onlooking. And for me, all of that, everything that I mentioned, kind of it also exposure therapy for me. You know, all the crowd sort of watching me, and, you know, because I was a damaged guy on the marathon, or a damaged guy on the push bike doing the races in Invictus.
Mm.
And I had, you know, crowds, sometimes thousands or tens of thousands of people watching me. But it helped me to come to terms with who I now was and accept me in the new skin and move forward in life. And so they were really valuable events for me. And I got a lot out of those.
Today, you are involved with resilience coaching as well. And through Help for Heroes, you've met people who have had their own issues, haven't you?
One of them lives up in Doncaster in Yorkshire, Ben Parkinson, MBE, for services to charity. We used to work together as patrons for a smaller charity. He's a remarkable gentleman. So he had a big injury, having been blown up in a military vehicle in Afghanistan. Ben was catapulted from the vehicle. And he had something like 38 separate recorded medical injuries. And it was a tremendous trauma. So he was TBI, traumatic brain injury, fractured his spine, rib cage, his sort of pelvis. I think he lost both legs. But what amazes me about Ben is his ability to fight on and to keep pushing. And he's got that really strong mindset, being a parachute soldier, 7 para Royal Horse Artillery. So really strong lad. He's got that mindset that I just admire. And in the early years, having got to know Ben, he spurred me on. He really did motivate me because I thought if Ben can do it, I can be the best version of myself. There's another chap that I'd also like to mention, another good friend of mine. He's in the Northwest in the Wigan area, a guy called Andy Reed. He was also awarded MBE for services to charity. Lovely gentleman. Andy and I have done a bit of work together in speaking on occasion. Similarly to Ben, he had an injury out in Afghanistan and lost 3 limbs. And I just can't get my head around how, the challenges of life following his injury. So he lost a leg below one knee and above the other knee. And he also lost one arm. Every day, Andy Reid gets up and gets on with it, so to speak. But more than that, he doesn't just live a life at home, sort of in the sedentary sense, but he cracks on and he does all kinds of charity work. And he's a great inspiration to his community where he's based up in the northwest of England. More than that, he's now speaking on a global platform. He's inspiring thousands of people all around the world.
In terms of inspiring people and giving people advice, we are at last out of COVID. A lot of people have gone through a lot of trauma, nothing like yours. What kind of advice would you give to people who find that their lives have completely changed?
But from my own experience, having been at the lowest ebb, my best advice is to always believe and never let that light flicker in your mind. And what I mean by that is to distinctly hold on at all costs, because no matter how dark life may seemingly stoop, there can always be light around the corner. And if you hold on just long enough, you can turn a corner. I mean, I didn't honestly believe that I could do it myself, given the gravitas of my own injuries and the ordeal that I faced back in 2007. But ultimately, I learned that, with great will and determination and that tenacity, that ability to hold on and to really keep pushing, I surprised myself. And that would be my advice to others. If you hold on, ultimately, you can surprise yourself. And that means you can still go on to conquer life and to continue to be the best version of yourself going forward.
Now, your inspirational story is an amazing book. Do you want to tell us about that book?
Book is called Life on a Thread: How My Fight for Survival Made Me Stronger, and it's published by Penguin. And I believe that it can help people, and it's available in hardback and audiobook and the ebook.
It is absolutely a must read book. And Jamie is a must meet character. If you're interested in getting Jamie to talk about mental resilience coaching, you can get hold of Jamie at specialistspeakers.com. They will sort that out for you. Jamie, once again, thank you so much for joining us here on Thought and Leaders.
It's an absolute pleasure, Jonathan.
And to everybody out there, remember, things happen in our lives, as Jamie just said. They can be devastating. They can be heartbreaking, make us feel that what's the point of anything? But he also said, and this is the key thing, you have it within yourself to surprise yourself, to become a better version of you, a 2.0.
Thank you very much, Jonathan.
Thought and Leaders is a Goodbye production. It is heard around the world, but we can't continue broadcasting without your support. If you are interested in sponsoring the show or are looking for award-winning content, including strategy and coaching, please DM us or email reinvent@me.com. That's reinvent@me.com.